Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Show Report, episode 14, if you're keeping track at home. This is where journalism is reviewed and the stories of the week are expanded and explained. I'm your host, Ryan Ripley. Joining me on this quest to shed the light of liberty on the week's news is publisher of We Are Libertarians, the one and only Chris Spangle.
Top of the morning.
And managing editor of the We Are Libertarians news site, Joe Ruiz.
Hey, I always go second, and I always like have to laugh at Chris's little intros.
I try to throw you two off.
You do a good job.
I almost went with Joe, I love TMZ Ruiz, yeah. But I didn't want to start the conflict too early.
Joe,
so much hatred in the world today.
Joe, it's been very, very difficult with the news of Zac Efron this week. Joe has been trying very hard to stay focused with Zac Efron having a brush with death.
And you know what? As if our audience cared, I learned that actually took place earlier this year and that the news was just released. He's actually out of rehab now.
Oh, thanks for that update.
You're welcome.
His Zac Efron Google alert.
Tell your wife.
Speaking of other things that are completely irrelevant, the Senate has blamed the media for NSA woes. You guys hear about this? Senators are getting real chirpy on Twitter and some other media outlets and even in session itself saying that it's not the NSA's fault for spying on us. It's the media for telling us that the NSA is spying on us. That's what's really causing all the problems. It doesn't surprise me that DiFi. For those of you not in the know, that you, if you don't know the lingo, that's Dianne Feinstein, the probably the dimmest bulb of the bunch. That's her reasoning anyways, is that if the media had not told the American public about the NSA, everything would be fine.
It's like if you're in an adulterous relationship, you know, and it's the argument that, okay, I'm cheating on you, but if you wouldn't have found out that I was cheating on you, everything would have been fine.
Yeah. It's the classic apology, not apology. Like, listen, I'm sorry if you got offended, you know, but yeah. You shouldn't have been snooping in my dresser drawer.
You know, what's worse is that they're not really even apologizing. They're saying this isn't a problem, and if the media would shut up, the problem would go away. And
that's because statists are going to state. Listen, they're the people who control the government are happy with the way the government runs, and that's why they freak out when people want to shut the government down.
You know, the real tragedy of living in Indiana is that we have Senator Dan Coats, who has been in on this nonsensical argument, and ultimately he didn't ask a question during a joint session, but Clapper came back and answered one anyways and quoted right back at Senator Coats, "You have very elegantly captured our frustration." So for our listening audience also in Indiana, it appears that Dan Coats is on board with the idea that that it is the media's fault and not the NSA.
Color me shocked.
The only member of the Senate Intelligence Committee who had the honesty and the integrity to point out just the nonsense of this argument was Democrat Ron Wyden. You know, he has called out just the lack of transparency and honesty from the Intelligence Committee leadership, and basically said that had they been straight with the American people from the beginning, the media would not have needed to do what they did. So golf clap to Senator Ron Wyden. Thank you for being the only honest one of the bunch. And to the rest of you, a big boo.
Apparently, Ron Wyden, I don't know if maybe you guys caught it, but Greg Lynn said that Ron Wyden made a weird statement that had people kind of questioning, is there more that we can look into? And he was very vague in the statement, and I wish I had it in front of me, but I'm just doing this off of memory from my conversation with Greg. Greg said he was presenting an idea so that journalists could go and do more digging and find out that there's more information on the NSA out there. So hopefully
I did catch that comment, and my first thought was, oh no, the only honest senator on the Intelligence Committee is about to go to prison.
Right. So what
I got very, I got very concerned that Ron Wyden had just stuck himself out on a limb that he might have said too much.
What was the comment? Do you remember the paraphrase of it at least?
I think he was discussing that cell phone GPS locations have may or may not have been tracked by the NSA. And so not only are the metadata, the metadata that everyone loves to talk about and minimalize, But it's also GPS tracking data. So if you turn on your GPS and you're at a certain location and you want to go to another location, it seems that the NSA might be grabbing that as well.
The idea that Apple is now collecting your fingerprint, doesn't that just make you all warm and fuzzy inside?
That's why I have an HTC One.
I'm sure that feature will be coming to your phone soon. The NSA demands it.
It's crazy, crazy. But they have to know your GPS location, because if they didn't know where you were at all times, it would be impossible to assign appropriate coordinates to the drones for guys like us.
Yeah. Well, how are the NSA analysts supposed to appropriately track their boyfriends and girlfriends if they can't have a GPS location?
I'm just saying, I'm not hard to find. Just find the local burger joint. Like, have the drone positioned over Teddy's Burger Joint, and you'll find me at least at some point. There's Five Guys near my house.
We see tie-dye on the heat map. That must be Spangle. Right.
So just when you see tie-dye going into the Five Guys, just shoot.
Fire away. Well, speaking of firing away, we had the opportunity to interview Dr. Noam Chomsky. So some of you may or may not be familiar with Dr. Chomsky. He is pretty much the end-all, be-all, is-all of the linguist academic discussion. Noted scholar in this area, professor at MIT, doctorate from, I believe, Penn State. Incredibly brilliant man when it comes to the language and how it works within our brains and whether or not language is a function of communication or internal dialogue. He takes on a lot of controversial positions in this area. He's also a noted political activist, very strongly minded in the political arena. Has some interesting thoughts on libertarianism and some of the things that we take seriously as a journalism-related podcast, and especially as liberty-minded individuals. And we had the great pleasure of talking to Dr. Chomsky. What amazes me, guys, is even at the age of 84, what a brilliant man. I mean, he still has the facts up there. He still has the arguments. I would not be comfortable going 10 rounds with him in an academic debate. I think he would demolish all three of us. What do you guys think?
Well, maybe two. Either. Maybe two of you. no, he is incredible. I think he's 86 now, if I remember, because I was reading a profile of him from the New Yorker. And, you know, he's incredibly prolific. He writes. He's got two new books out with a third coming out. He's constantly publishing new papers. He's a professor at MIT, so he has a regular teaching schedule, you know, and I hope at 86 that I am still as engaged intellectually as he is, you know, so really kudos to him, and can't thank him enough for doing an interview on a podcast. So he's got a new book out, which is on Western terrorism, from Hiroshima to drone warfare. So we talked a little bit about that, but it was a really, really interesting conversation. So.
So, Joe, what really stuck out with you on the Chomsky interview that you'd want to comment on, or what really, you know, with the other interviews that we've had, Dr. Paul, Professor Tucker, there's been some excellent takeaways. With Dr. Chomsky, certainly no different. A lot of pearls dropped. Just wondering which one that you picked up.
I think it was just his kind of overall essence and the way that he communicated. I love, and you'll get to the first question here shortly, the way that he answered that question. However, you could tell it wasn't his first rodeo, and yet he stays so incredibly calm while he's answering these questions. And if we were bold enough to try and go academically 10 rounds with him, I have a feeling that he would still maintain that type of cool. It just seems to me that that's the kind of person he is. And, you know, all of the gears are turning full speed ahead, and yet he's just, like, answering the question in the most calm and collected way possible. It's like it's like someone throwing line by line of a textbook at your face, except he's, you know, a smart enough guy that he probably wrote that textbook.
Yeah,
he certainly left the mark on us as well, that he did come back at us a few times. Let's go ahead and play that interview. Let the listeners check out our discussion with Dr. Noam Chomsky, and then we will come back and give some more commentary, a few closing thoughts, and keep on moving through the news of the week. So here's our interview with Noam Chomsky. First off, you're a noted linguist and a pioneer in the field. You know, imagine your audience is not familiar with linguistics. Why does this area of study matter to them? How does it impact their lives?
Well, the most it's been recognized for many centuries that the most distinctive intellectual cognitive characteristic of humans, and in fact the core of their nature is the ability to use their language freely, creatively, independently. This is the foundation of a good part of Cartesian philosophy. It goes right through modern history. And it's an obvious fact. There are 7 billion humans in the world and a few tens of thousands of monkeys. And a part of the main reason for it is that humans have language. So to understand and to discover the nature of this quite remarkable ability is a fundamental question for anyone concerned with the nature of human beings.
Recently, we've seen a brush with American involvement in another military engagement. What are some of the what is some of the language that those in power use to seduce Americans into another military engagement? What are some of the signs that we can signs of propaganda that we ought to watch for?
Well, for example, take there's a notion that right now there's debate going on, lively debate between what's called exceptionalism and isolationism. Exceptionalism is the view that we are so marvelous and amazing that we must continue to devote our blood and resources to solving other people's problems all over the world, as we've been doing for 7 decades, as Obama put it the other night. Isolationism is described as the view that yes, indeed, we are amazing and unique, but we better attend to our own problems rather than putting out the fires lit by these unworthy foreigners. That's the debate. There's also a truth to the matter. The truth to the matter is that for Obama's 7 decades, we've been a rogue state, violating international law, invading other countries, overthrowing democratic governments, installing brutal dictatorships. We've left a trail of blood and misery and destruction right up to the present. But that's just fact. Propaganda tells us we're not allowed to look at that fact. These are insignificant facts. What matters is the ideal conception of the United States as a uniquely exceptional idealistic country. Actually, this was put rather well by Hans Morgenthau, the founder of hard-headed, no-nonsense, realist international relations theory. He argued that the United States is unique among countries in history, in that it has a purpose, a transcendental purpose. The purpose is equality, freedom, all wonderful things. But he was a good scholar, and he reviewed the record briefly, and he said that if you look at the record, it looks like as though the United States hasn't really attained its, lived up to its transcendental purpose. But he says to criticize the transcendental purpose in these grounds, on these grounds, is like the error of atheism, which denies God's goodness by looking at evil in the world. And his point, though this is not what he intended, is correct. It's a religion. It's a secular religion. And contrary evidence just doesn't matter. That's the most extreme form of propaganda that one can imagine. Very few historical analogs to such a successful propaganda campaign. So the debate is the alleged debate is waged within a framework which is so dramatically false that you can hardly even laugh at it. But as Morgenthau said, that's irrelevant since we have a religion which claims that the premises are correct.
So, Dr. Chomsky, in your new book, On Western Terrorism, From Hiroshima to Drone Warfare, I believe that the argument that you just gave is really the subtext of that book, and it really is an indictment of U.S. foreign policy. So given that the exceptionalism stance is turned into its own religion or its own false idol, as some would say, and that false idol has overtaken the ability to reason out the true facts and ultimate carnage of our current policy, what would you say is the right U.S. foreign policy, and how could we actually get to, you know, a better standing in the world?
Well, actually, there were several far-reaching polls by the major polling agencies a couple of years ago, which asked people about these questions, and they gave answers, which I wrote about them. I thought they were pretty sound. I wouldn't have put it quite that way, but I basically thought that the public opinion on this was sound. The public holds that by considerable margins, that in international crises, the United Nations should take the lead, not the United States. And the United States should go along with the will of the majority. In fact, a majority of the public even thought that the veto should be given up at the United Nations for everyone, and that if the United States didn't like, as not too many people know, the United States is way in the lead in the United Nations in vetoing Security Council resolutions. Britain second, no one else even close. That's since 1965, when the UN became moderately representative of world opinion. That's not well known, but it's a fact. Anyhow, the slight majority of the public thought that the U.S. should just go along with world opinion without a veto, even if we don't like it. Well, I think that's pretty sensible. That's pretty much the doctrines of the founding fathers, who insisted that we should have a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. And I think, and in other respects too, I think public opinion has been fairly sound, except in those unique moments when a massive propaganda drives people into a kind of hysteria. So immediately, right when the Bush administration, for example, was planning to invade Iraq, its worst crime of this millennium, there was a flood of propaganda about how if we don't quickly invade, the next thing we'll hear from Iraq will be a mushroom cloud over New York. You probably remember that. And it got people were frightened enough. So that only in the United States, not anywhere else, that there was a majority of support for this act of blatant criminal aggression. But those are rare moments, and the propaganda really has to be geared up to a massive level to achieve that. Most of the time, the public is pretty sound. Now, so what is isolationism? What's called isolationism is actually the view that we should observe international law, act like a law-abiding state, and not be a rogue state that claims the right to use violence when it feels like, claiming that it's for noble objectives, that makes about as much, you look at history, that's about as justifiable as other great powers that have made the same claim, and typically they do.
All right, this is primarily a media-focused podcast, and so I kind of wanted to get your opinion on how do you think that the American public should approach the mainstream media? In your opinion, are they still relevant and reliable?
Well, I'll just tell you my own practice. First thing I do in the morning, I just did it, in fact, is read a couple of newspapers, the New York Times, a couple of local quality newspapers, the business press, I turn to the international press, and that gives you, and then I go on to read a wide variety of journals across the spectrum, scholarly journals, books, and so on. But the major media are the main source of news and information. And generally, the facts are reliable. So, for example, what I was just describing is the framework of discussion. But within that framework, if you look at what's described, you learn a lot. You simply have to extricate yourself from the propaganda framework, which is so deeply entrenched that it's completely unconscious. I mean, this secular religion that I described is rather different from, evangelical Christianity or Orthodox Judaism, the culture I partially grew up in. My grandfather, for example, was an ultra-religious Jew, but he knew he was religious. The purveyors of the Orthodox, of the state religion, don't even know it. They think they have no beliefs. They're just being objective. That's a much higher level of subordination to religious doctrine. And people who read the press, as they should if they want to know what's going on in the world, like, say, the New York Times, best newspaper in the world, in fact, should do so, learning what they can, but recognizing that the framework is of commentary and discussion is very sharply distorted by a religious doctrine that's pervasive. For example, right now there's article after article asking whether Iran is finally willing to negotiate with the United States. Well, anybody who bothers to look into it will quickly discover that it's the United States which has been blocking, not entirely, but significantly, blocking any steps towards negotiations. And in fact, when there were real achievements made that could have ended the crisis, the U.S. stepped in and blocked them. You have to do a little work to discover this, but it's in the press. So if you go back to 2010, Turkey and Brazil reached an agreement with Iran in which Iran would send all of its low-enriched uranium out of the country for storage to Turkey, and in return, the Western countries would provide isotopes for Iran's medical reactor. Okay, that would have ended the crisis. As soon as it was announced, it was bitterly denounced by the government here. Brazil was denounced. The press reflexively went along. It just repeats what the government says, denounced Brazil, denounced Turkey. Obama made quickly move to sanctions. The Brazilian foreign minister was sufficiently annoyed so that he released a letter from President Obama to President Da Silva of Brazil, in which Obama had made exactly this suggestion, apparently assuming that Iran wouldn't accept it, and then we'd have a propaganda point. But when they accepted it, it was denounced. Now, if you read the press carefully, really carefully, you can discover these facts, but you have to read it carefully. And once you and this is not the only one by any means. Once you learn these things, you can then approach the morning newspaper with a framework of understanding which will allow you to decode the distortions and find the facts. And it's incidentally very useful to read critical commentary, which is now easily available on the Internet, which goes through all these things.
You've referred to yourself as a libertarian socialist. How does that differ from the libertarianism best identified in Ron Paul, the Cato Institute, or the National Libertarian Party?
Well, the term libertarian in the United States has a meaning quite different from what it's meant traditionally in the long European tradition. Their libertarian just is the anti-state wing of the socialist movement. So the critics of the Bolsheviks from the left, left-wing critics of the Bolsheviks, who regarded Bolshevism as kind of a right-wing deviation, they were libertarian socialists. They didn't believe and they opposed the power of the tyrannical state. The term libertarian, and in fact they opposed any form, libertarian socialists opposed any form of illegitimate authority and domination. American libertarians are quite different. They favor tyranny, but the tyranny of private power. They don't want the state to be in a position to restrict and limit the power of private capital concentrations, corporations. That's advocacy of a form of tyranny, a form of unaccountable private tyranny. And that's quite different from the libertarian tradition, which was opposed to tyranny of any kind.
If I may just ask one follow-up, I know we're long on time here. You know, we are more libertarian in the strain of Ron Paul and the Cato Institute, but you know, our view is that there should be no force, no coercion, and if individuals are acting in harmony with each other, then I don't see how that's tyranny necessarily.
If there's no rules, you can call them coercion if you like driving on the right instead of driving anywhere you like. If there are no rules, then what will happen is very evident. We see it before us. There's plenty of historical evidence. Concentrations of capital will accumulate. They'll grow larger and larger. They'll be uncontrolled and unconstrained. They'll be predatory and destructive. And the free choices that you'll have will be either to submit to them with whatever constraints they impose, or to starve.
Well, we're long on time, but I wanted to thank you for indulging us in that one last follow-up there. So thank you very much, and we appreciate you taking the time to talk to our audience, and really have enjoyed talking to you.
Good to talk to you.
Well, that was great. Chris, you seemed to have a little tussle at the end of it. Dr. Chomsky did not have a positive view of American libertarianism. Perhaps you could dive into his argument a bit. I believe it was the Somalia argument that the libertarian movement will ultimately lead to anarchy, and then it just turns into Somalia, wherever the ideas, you know, prosper and spread. So I know that we don't agree with that. Chris, could you kind of give the highlights of that argument and just the...
Anything that I read, I think his linguistics is really interesting. You know, how grammar is formed. I think his conversation on how to spot propaganda is interesting. But then we get to, you know, capitalism, and then it gets a little bit murky there. You know, his view of, you know, the libertarianism that we outlined, that the three of us expound upon, is that the individual is the basic unit of measurement. So we're all individuals. We each have make individual choices, and you know, we force starts with us. Okay, so if you look at it to make it very simple, if you have two children on the playground and they're arguing, they can argue all they want, but as soon as someone throws a punch, then that is when force is used, and that person is wrong, and the other person has the right to defend themselves. So, you know, we believe that individuals should never throw that punch. We should all live in harmony with each other. And it's in our best interest to live in harmony with one another. And the same goes for economics. If a corporation, which wouldn't even exist, the corporations, and I think this is partly where his argument sort of erodes, because a lot of people within his strain of libertarianism believe, you know, corporations are evil, capitalism is bad, we'll all be enslaved, and that's maybe a gross misrepresentation. I'm sure he'd take umbrage with that. But, you know, the corporation that the three of us work for is really designed by the federal government. It's designed by the IRS, so it's defined by the state. And it would not exist in a truly free market. In a truly free market, bad practices in business and economics would eventually and quickly wither away and die, because if you were cheating, if you were lying, if you were stealing, if you're using violence, then the society turns on you and says, no, we're not going to have that. And so people stop buying your product. People stop associating with you. And libertarians in our strain believe that it all comes down to the individual. What choices are you making? It truly is the golden rule. So are you choosing to treat others with respect? Are you choosing to treat others with dignity, with equality, with justice? With, you know, not forcing your principles and values on others? And are they doing the same? And if they're not, then you don't associate with them. Okay, it's voluntary associations. And I think, and I know that Greg Lenz has argued this point, is that the socialist libertarian strain doesn't have a proper view of free market economics, and that if they dived into that a little bit more, then they would understand that basic unit. So that's sort of where my question came from. You know, it's the Somalia argument. It's, you know, in our version of libertarianism, you'd have Somalia. Well, Somalia and Rwanda are not libertarian paradises, because if we believe in the non-initiation of force we don't believe in initiating force to achieve social or political goals. Well, that is clearly not Rwanda, where they are using violence and force and murder to achieve political and social goals. Mm-hmm. So it isn't a valid argument. So that's kind of why I argued with him a little bit on that. And, you know, I know that we knew going into this that he had that view of our belief system, but we felt that we here at We Are Libertarians believe that it's good to hear arguments about yourself. We don't want to protect you from things that might make you mad, because if you protect yourself from it, then you can't deal with it. You can't create arguments against it.
Yeah, absolutely. I would hope. And forming arguments, Joe, is something that your question teased out. I was really happy when you asked Dr. Chomsky about his take on the media, how he approaches it, and he answered it in such a way that he just laid out his routine. You know, what did you take away from the way that Dr. Chomsky approaches the media, and what lessons should our listeners really have pulled out from there?
Well, first of all, I wanted to go back to the last question. I had something that I wanted to share with that. I would hope that Dr. Chomsky and a man of his high intellectualism would be able to at least appreciate voluntary associations to the extent that it's responsible for the amount of influence that he's been able to have in society. You don't write that many books and publish that many books and continue to be able to do so unless people are buying them. So people are obviously voluntarily opting into buying them. That's the free market at work, because they're doing that without any sort of government force or intervention. And so that's the beauty of a free market, a voluntary society on a very small scale. And so I think someone who has his view should be able to at least look at that snapshot and appreciate it.
We all have a lot to erode to get to the point where we have these arguments. You know, it's Maya and I argue all the time about minarchist versus anarchist. You probably know what an anarchist is, but look up in Wikipedia what a minarchist is, and that's how I would identify myself. I believe that's like the true libertarian view, but Maya thinks that anarchism is the true libertarian view. Well, we've got like 150 years of rolling crap back to get to that point, you know, and it's the same with James Neese, our friend, and Noam Chomsky, and their belief of libertarian socialism. So it's fun to have these arguments, but we still have, you know, you saw it with the interview, we did the stuff that we have to deal with now, and then we had the fun philosophical question at the end.
Well, it's fun to play in the land of fantasy, but eventually you got to put your feet back on the ground, deal with the reality of the day, and, you know, while we wish that things could be a certain way, we do have a structure to work within or around or under right now. So the arguments are fun, they're intellectually stimulating, but ultimately we got to get back to the true work of bringing forward productive change.
But I certainly do appreciate his going through his habit of how he consumes the media. And Jeffrey Tucker did the same thing when we interviewed him. And I think that should be, going forward, something regular that we ask our guests, because as a media podcast, it's important to know how influential figures are taking it all in.
Well, it is important, because there is a heavy media slant right now, and especially on the Obamacare debate and the government shutdown that could occur if Obamacare is defunded or not funded, or however you want to put it. And it's something that the three of us have been talking about pretty extensively, either through our chat system or just in, you know, over the internet. And I wanted to bring this up because the media has decided to slant the Obamacare debate and the government shutdown as the GOP, or for, again, the lingo, the Republicans holding out for their way or the highway. You know, and even yesterday in President Obama's address, he made it clear that, you know, the Republicans are simply trying to take their ball and go home if they don't get their way. And it, the slant is really, at least in my own opinion, and I hope you guys agree, that they're really ignoring the fact that the president started the entire conversation with, "I refuse to negotiate." And so when you start off with those words, having another side willing to bend just doesn't seem possible. Yet that part of the discussion has been dropped by the mainstream media, and I don't think that message is getting through very well. I'm kind of curious your guys' insights as to why is the blame a one-way street, and why isn't the president taking some of the blame for his obstructionist stance as well? Because, guys, really, he's not willing to negotiate, and the Republicans are making a list of demands. And so when you have that kind of stalemate, doesn't it truly take two sides to cause an impasse?
Well, remember when we talked to Ron Paul and he had that that little soundbite where he talked about the people have to kind of do some soul searching in terms of what they feel the appropriate role of government is. And I think that this is a reflection on what people, a society, as a majority, is willing to accept as the role of government at this point, because they see the president as the leader. And they disregard the power that we have through checks and balances and through representative government, or that we could have. And so when they hear him say, "This is the way that I think it should be, and I'm not going to negotiate it," they take it as, well, that's just the boss kind of giving his you know, demands down to the lower peons in the lower chambers here of the Senate and the House of Representatives. And that's a terrible way to accept information. We shouldn't be doing that. What we should be doing is saying, no, 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 no. You know, there's more of them than there are of you. You know, we need to go bottom up, and we need to make sure that our representatives know exactly what the their take on the issues of the day should be when they go in to vote. And there are a handful of senators and House representatives that they have the right mindset. They're not going to take this is what I told you to do, and this is the way it's going to be. Okay, now give me your feedback. But just exclude anything that would negate anything that I just told you is going to be the way it is. And those people, you know, are the people we talk about regularly, the Justin Amashes, the Rand Pauls, the Ted Cruzes, you know, even like you said with what we just talked about, the Ron Wyden.
Mike Lee.
Yeah, Mike Lee, absolutely. And those people are out there saying it's about what the people want. Even at the end of Ted Cruz's filibuster, when he was talking to Harry Reid, he asked him if he would yield his time, and he said, "I won't yield my time until you yield to the American people." I just thought that was a beautiful sentiment. And so we've got to get to the point where we're refusing to accept, "I'm not willing to negotiate on this, 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 and this," because this is representative government. It's not your call. We elected you. You're going to hear what we have to say, or else the Democrats will no longer be in power. The Republicans will no longer be in power. We have to do what they've been doing all along and decide to just start taking the power grabs, because it really is supposed to lie within us constitutionally. Rant ended.
Jeez, did you drop the mic too? So, you know, Radley Balco was here in Indiana, in Bloomington, at his alma mater at Indiana University, speaking to the SFL and YAL group there. And he has
a Chris, what are those two acronyms for those that don't know the lingo?
Oh, yeah. Good point. Students for Liberty and Young Americans for Liberty. And YAL is more politically activism, especially for libertarian Republicans like Amash and Rand Paul. And then SFL is more philosophically based. And, you know, on most college campuses, you start both because two different feathers of the bird, I guess. So what he talked about was, he has a new book out called The Rise of the Warrior Cop, and Radley Balco has done a great job of bringing to the mainstream the notion that police forces have become militarized, and that is bad because the idea of a military is to kill things and break things and annihilate the enemy. And a police force, their mission is to keep the peace and to uphold rights. And when you militarize a police force, then bad results happen. At the end, when we're talking about solutions and what do we do about this problem, he says, well, you have to make it politically untenable. and you have to get the, you know, these are word, my words, not his. You have to make the spineless little weasels fear for their jobs by making it politically untenable, putting pressure on them. And what the Tea Party and the libertarian strain and the grassroots Republicans have done to their party is put pressure on politicians to make spending and big government politically untenable. And that's what Ted Cruz is doing. And that's what the media does not see. Because the media, the Beltway media, the Politicos, the Hill, the, you know, the columnists that write for the Washington Post and the cable news channels, all are based in Washington, D.C. They live in a world of pragmatism. They live in a world of this is the how the government is, this is how things ought to operate. And they don't break out of their bubbles very often. They don't see what the grassroots are doing. They don't see that it's they don't see that it's politically untenable for these guys to vote certain ways anymore. Because the Republican Party for so long has come back to their districts and said one thing and gone to Washington, D.C. and done another. Dan Coats. And so the Washington media misses that. The Beltway media misses that because they are living in a world of what is possible, and the grassroots Republicans are living in a world of what ought to be. And those two do not reconcile each other. And what we are seeing is, to be honest, Ted Cruz's stunt was a publicity stunt because there was no way that they're going to kill Obamacare. The math just does not work. The fact is that there is not the votes in the House and the Senate. There is not the votes in the one that matters, the veto of the president. And so you've got to win more elections. And that is really why I think we see the disconnect, is because the Beltway media looks at the math and the practical math of the situation and says that this is a cause that you cannot fulfill. So what's the point of it? Why even go out there and rant for a few hours like Joe Ruiz? You can't do it. It's not going to happen. So what is the point? And the point is that you get your message out the day before the exchanges start, and mm-hmm. you create a negative environment about a program mm-hmm. that is going to fail if people won't enroll in the program. And if people hear that it's terrible and it's bad for you right before the exchange is open, then not enough people sign up because their behavior is affected by the filibuster, and therefore the program will end. So they don't see that there is a level of pragmatism to all of this because they're stuck within their own little bubble.
So do you guys think that the worst problem that the GOP faces right now is that Obamacare could work? Is that why they're so guarded and trying to set up these negative environments? And is this what the mainstream media is working against?
I don't think the math works in Obamacare either, just like the math on the votes to repeal it and fighting over the debt ceiling. That's not going to work, and neither will the math of Obamacare. You can't grow government bigger. The bigger the government, the easier it is to fall and fail. So,
well, yeah. Not only, I mean, that has a lot to do with what I'm about to say too. Is just that it's unaffordable. You know, even if it were the absolute greatest policy which has ever, you know, come through the ranks of government, we are at a point in American history where, you know, the bank is broken. And how are we going to pay for such an expensive policy, regardless of the good that it could potentially do or the bad that it could potentially do? We just can't afford it. How do you get around that?
I don't think you do. I think that, we all agree it's doomed to fail. You know, but the question really is, why does the mainstream media keep carrying water for the president and for this program? And that's something that Seymour Hersh really called out in a recent op-ed that appeared in The Guardian, The Huffington Post, and a few other papers. I wanted to talk to you guys about this real quick. This is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's got some very extreme ideas on how to fix journalism in general. He's basically saying close down the alphabet soup news bureaus like NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, and basically fire 90% of the editors and journalists and get back to the fundamental job of reporting, which he said requires that you're an outsider. Interesting quote from him during this op-ed is, Don't even get him started on the New York Times, which he says spends so much time carrying water for the Obama administration, more than he ever thought they would. Or the death of Osama bin Laden. Nothing's been done about that story. It's one big lie. Not one word of it's true, he says, of the dramatic U.S. Navy SEALs raid in 2011. So clearly, Mr. Hirsch, credible journalist, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and has some serious bones to pick with the New York Times, with the mainstream media, with the alphabet soup mainstream outlets. And he's really just dropping the hammer on their inability to report as outsiders and calling them out for carrying the water of the administration. You know, guys, is this a case where is it time to burn it down and start over? Or is there a path to redemption for what we call journalism in America?
I think the path that we will see is that the pro-power media outlets will eventually be the recipients of government grants and government bailouts to keep reporters employed. And there will be a lot of people who just will take the job because they want a job and they want to have a quote-unquote journalism job. And then there will be a lot of principled people who will leave and start independent sites, and you'll see those sites get bigger and bigger, and then one day they become the pro-power large media outlets. I mean, that's sort of the cyclical nature of the world. I don't believe in a liberal media. I don't believe in a there is a conservative media, and there is a liberal media. But when you call the New York Times and ABC liberal media outlets, I don't believe that. I believe that the mentality, having worked in and around journalists for the last 10 years, the mindset is pro-power and anti-power. And there are not a lot of anti-power journalists out there. There is a lot of pro-power journalists. They are comfortable with the idea of a bigger government and more government power. And we need more libertarian journalists. We need more people like Radley Balco. We need more people like Glenn Greenwald, who are anti-power and are willing to question the power of the government. And what you see in these alphabet soup, so-called alphabet soup mainstream media, is the inclination to become a press release factory for the government, all forms of government. And that's the problem, because then they become it's the tyranny of access. They stop questioning because they want to make sure that they have access. And if they step too far out of line, then they become ridiculed by their peers, like Glenn Greenwald. And I think that Cy Hirsch is onto something, and you're not going to get people just to burn down their own organizations and their jobs. I mean, people, you know, what's the incentive there? Like, okay, I'm going to just get rid of my news department that brings me revenue? No, it'll just become ever more ridiculous, and independent journalists will start to rise.
If the TMZ correspondent can make a statement real quick, I think Cy Hirsch made an important statement in saying that the fundamental job of journalists was to be an outsider, and it reminds me of the movie Almost Famous. Do you remember that movie? Because you remember the Rolling Stone editor told the reporter, don't become friends with the bands, don't become friends with the artists, because you lose your ability to be objective. And for some reason, that's what I think of when I think you get too close to the people in Washington. All these organizations move to Washington. And I imagine in my head, and I can speculate, that they probably established some good relationships. Maybe these people are going out to drinks with, you know, someone who works on the White House, someone who works on Capitol Hill. And instead of being objective, then they base everything off of their relationship, like you said, their ability to gain access. And it becomes something that really it shouldn't become as a journalist. And so I think that comparison plays well.
Hirsch's argument really comes down to, if you're not making the establishment mad, all you are is a PR firm. And I think we've talked about that concept before, and it's one that I highly agree with. If you're publishing stories that does not lead to a direct phone call from Jay Carney chewing you out, are you actually doing your job?
I really think that people like ABC or the Wall Street Journal should hire Maya Axton to be their White House correspondent.
Good God.
Wow.
What have you done?
You are not serious until you hire Maya Axton.
I think actually here's the thing with Maya. Maya is militant, but Maya is also incredibly bright. And I think she would be able to she doesn't care about the power. She doesn't care about being liked. She doesn't care about being friends with these people. I think she would actually be an amazing White House correspondent. I think it would put any administration on their toes. Chris, I know we're saying it tongue in cheek. I think she would actually go in and light things up and be the type of person that Mr. Hirsch is asking for.
I'm not even saying it tongue in cheek. I'm saying hire her now. You know, Maya, there is a method to Maya's madness, to the Maya Axton character. So, you know, if you don't know who we're talking about, go to theuncontrollables.com. You're welcome.
You know, part of the question of the mainstream media was brought forth in a recent article on the Daily Caller. And the headline was, should Ezra Klein quit the Washington Post? And Ben Domich says yes. And the reasons are pretty interesting and fall right in line with the philosophies of the show. You know, Facebook and Twitter have changed the game and allow journalists to have the opportunity to do better on their own. He argues that is it even important for a talented journalist with a decent brand and a solid Twitter following to be associated with a larger media outlet anymore? He actually thinks that some writers are leaving too much money on the table by settling for a salary instead of leveraging their platforms, using their brand, and using those new type of media outlets to push out their own message. You know, he's basically saying that the old models are done, you know, dead on arrival. People like Ezra Klein have such a huge following and platform that they can monetize their thoughts and commentary and ability to report the news. And it should be something that they actually turn into a viable business and build on it. You know, what do you guys think? Are these journalists that have the followings making a massive mistake by tying their wagon up with an alphabet soup, large mainstream media outlet?
Let me compare Ezra Klein to Tegan Goddard. Tegan Goddard is one of the most prolific journalists out there today. He runs the Political Wire, the Wonk Wire at Roll Call. He also writes the Cloakroom at The Week. And he is constantly pushing out information. He's always got stuff like a week before anybody else. And he really just kind of he worked behind the scenes and kind of off the radar at some of these bigger places and started his own site and has built up his own little thing. And, you know, he's just not as well known as Ezra Klein. He doesn't make it to the magic box as often as Ezra Klein. He doesn't get the, you know, but I think he's more prolific. He's more interesting. Ezra Klein starts out at these bigger places, gets the bigger platform, and more people know who he is. And that's the difference. That's why it's necessary to work at some of these places, is because Ezra Klein wouldn't have the platform that he does and the Twitter followers that he does if he didn't work at the Washington Post. And you have to go there, you have to stand out, and then you sort of rise to the top. I mean, I don't know. I don't agree with Tegan Goddard and Ezra Klein politically, but they always have interesting stuff and interesting points of view, and they're unique. They're different. They stand out. And Ezra Klein has built the wonk blog at Washington Post into something that you want to read every day because you're going to get something interesting. The same with Chris Sisla in The Fix. And they are good editors. They know what people are going to be interested in. But you wouldn't know that if they weren't on the Washington Post website. And that is sort of, while I agree with the article, I think it misses that point.
You know, this is a good topic for Ben Swan. We're going to have Ben Swan on the show in October, and I think this would be something that we should probably put on the shelf and ask him, because he is someone who has worked for kind of establishment news organizations and then decided to drop out and kind of become his own brand, and a lot of people look to him for news. So I think that he would be a perfect person to ask about this to get some personal perspective from someone who's done it.
You know, I think this comes down to it's a matter of you pay your dues like any other profession. You do excellent work. You rise to the top. You get a following. And then that's your brand. And so once you've built that out, you know, regardless of whether or not you've joined a large outlet or if you've worked from the bottom. I mean, a guy like Matt Drudge started getting a few leads, published a site, and all of a sudden he's one of the widest read journalists in the country. You know, but he also, I believe, started as a mainstream journalist. And then went to blogging. I know that others have made that same transition. You know, could a Glenn Greenwald of today survive as an independent blogger? Well, that's how he got his job with The Guardian. I'm sure he could go back to blogging, and he now has a platform that would be very successful. So it's a chicken and the egg kind of question where I think you do pay your dues, but you still have to do excellent work, and that's always the rub. That's how you get the followers. That's how you get the Twitter retweets and all that. It's that you do excellent work. And guys, I think it's just the old adage that talented people are always well fed. So definitely an interesting question. You know, building the platform is something that we're definitely interested in on this podcast. And it's something that, you know, Joe, we've got a few other guests coming up that have built some interesting platforms. We have Julie Borowski coming on in October mm-hmm. as well. You know, she took a YouTube channel and 2-minute videos, and she's parlayed that into appearing on the John Stossel show. Mm-hmm. She's really making some headway into building her brand and building a platform. So that will definitely be an interesting conversation. We also have Libertarian Girl, who is a Facebook phenomenon, who she's basically put together a massive following of people on Facebook and other social media outlets. She gets quite a few comments and quite a few readers, and she's got this platform that she's now parlaying into conference keynote appearances and other activities as well. So it's interesting to see that people are able, even like Ben Swan, who went out, he was part of the mainstream media, went out on his own, created his own platform, and seems to be doing incredibly well with it. We'll talk to him about that too. Mm-hmm. It seems that the ability to build that platform off of past success in the mainstream area is important, but then people like Julie Borowski, who does not have a journalism background, she too can go out there and build that platform just like Libertarian Girl. So it'll be interesting to hear the various backgrounds, and it's shaping up to be a very interesting October indeed.
Definitely. And don't forget, when you're talking about people like Julie Borowski and Libertarian Girl, we are Libertarians Crew because we're awesome.
Right. That's our platform.
Disagree.
There was just no such a silence. There was such an awkward silence there, like, why is he plugging ourselves? Like,
well,
what
we're just
going to
cut that part out, so I'm not worried about it. But
all right.
No, Joe's
who's,
right. The
who's this we?
Platform is it's a growing news site. It's a growing podcasting organization. It's definitely evolving and changing and growing, and we've seen a lot of leaps and bounds recently, a lot of new listeners, and we appreciate each and every one of you guys that are tuning in and checking out the message.
I personally think it sucks.
Yeah,
I hate Libertarians.
I'm the only one that gives this organization the credit it deserves. And someday, I'm going to be happy to talk with you, Chris, and say, you know, you started this organization. Look where we're at now. I think it's about time I gave you the I told you so.
I believe in not getting happy. Do better.
I'm with Chris on that. But before we break our arms, patting ourselves on the back, I think we've put in a good... a good week's work, and it's time for some Jay Carney Says What.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Yay.
So here's the game for those of you that are new to the show, and we do have some new people, and again, thank you so much. This is Jay Carney Says What. This is where we pick on, just a little bit, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney. We take a question that one of the White House correspondents asked him. We offer three options to Chris and Joe, and they get to pick which is the true answer to the question that was posed to Jay Carney. Now, this week, guys, of course, Obamacare has been the main message, and there are some people in the media looking to trip Jay up a little bit. He deserves it. It's okay. And I believe it's Ed Henry from Fox News. Chris, did I get that right?
You did. He is the White House correspondent and a previous head of the White House Correspondents Organization.
Ed is incredibly upset with Jay Carney right now. They have been going back and forth on so many different questions. It's been a very contentious week for Ed and Jay.
He just keeps looking at him and saying, Jay Carney says what?
I'm sure that if Ed Henry knew about this game, he would love it. And I hope we can get him on the show one day and play around with him, because I think this would be a kick for him. So this week, Ed Henry asked Jay Carney, will Jay Carney enroll in Obamacare? That is the question. Will Jay Carney enroll in Obamacare? Three possible answers. Here we go. Here's number one from Jay Carney. If I, in a future life, don't have employer-provided health care, Ed, does everyone agree that you can ask questions and I can answer them, but you aren't even letting me answer them? Absolutely. Ed! All right. I would enroll if I did not have employer-provided health insurance, like I'm sure you do, unless there's something about Fox that I don't know. I would absolutely enroll, and it would be more affordable. So there's answer one. Answer number two. If I want affordable health care, then enrollment is my best. Ed, come on, Ed. By if, I mean that I have employer-provided health coverage. Look, this is the most affordable that health care coverage has been in recent memory. Next week, the American people will finally have access to real coverage that they can afford. That's answer number two. Answer number three, no, I will not be enrolling. I have employer-provided health coverage just like everyone else in this room. If I were not fortunate enough to receive employer coverage, then Obamacare enrollment would be my most affordable option and the only way I know of that I could find adequate and responsible. Ed, let me finish. It does not cost less than the current premiums, Ed. It is the only, Ed, come on, it's the only way that I could find adequate and responsible coverage. All right, so there's three options there. Each one of them involve Ed and Jay interrupting and going after each other. The first one, let's recap it real quick. The first one was that in a future life, if he needed to do it, he would, and he would love it because it's more affordable. The second one is, look, we all have health provider or employer provided coverage here. This is a real opportunity for the American people to have coverage, not for the rest of us. And the third is just a flat out no. I am not enrolling because I don't need to. And if I didn't have coverage, I would.
Okay, number three is out because that's too much of an actual answer. And Jay Carney never actually gives an answer. So that one's okay. Definitely not it. So now it's between the one where he insults Fox News and the one where he eloquently promotes Obamacare. Now, he's not good at eloquently promoting things, even though he's the press secretary for the president. And he does hate Fox News, but my gut tells me that number two is the answer. And when you have a gut as substantial as mine, you must follow it.
Chris Spangle is going with number two, which is essentially the eloquent way of defending Obamacare without insulting Ed Henry. All right, Joe, which way are you going?
I'm going with Chris on this one.
So we both are locked in at number two. You're assuming
risky
that Jay
move.
Carney took the high road. Let's play the clip and let's hear how Jay handled this.
Anyway, from the Wall Street Journal, let's take the attacks on Republicans out. You're talking about enrollment. Will Jay Carney enroll in this? Will White House staff enroll in Obamacare?
Again, everybody, you, if you have him.
Let's start with you.
If I, in a future life, don't have employer
premiums, so great.
Ed, does everybody here agree that like, we can ask questions and answer them? But if you want to, you're not even letting me answer the question, Ed.
Go ahead and answer.
I'm not quite sure what your
would
your,
you enroll,
your goal here.
Would you enroll?
Absolutely.
It's a simple question.
Okay, absolutely.
So you are going to.
If I did not have employer provided health insurance, like I'm sure you do, unless there's something about Fox I don't know, then I would absolutely enroll, and it would be more affordable because of it. And I think you'll see that around the country. But
and after listening to that clip, guys, you both know that you are both wrong.
Come on.
Jay Carney and Ed Henry went back and forth, as we heard in the clip. It was an absolute disaster in the press room, and he even took a parting shot at Fox News. Jay is having a horrible week with Obamacare. Ed Henry is not giving him any breathing room. This is just one of many back and forths, and I love it. Because, hey, it caused you guys to be wrong yet again on America's favorite game, Jay Carney Says What.
See, like, Ryan is such a better statist than Jay Carney. I'm really worried about this.
Well, if they want me to start doing the White House press briefings,
breast
I am
briefings?
Available.
They haven't had White House breast briefings since Clinton.
Yeah, that's a good idea, Ryan. You can go be an apologist for anything that the president does, and I think Greg Lenz would have a field day with
that.
Yeah,
we all know you're a big Democrat.
I said press briefings, Chris.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think Greg would have a field day if I ever showed up behind that podium and just, oh, Obamacare's rolling out great. The delays were for everyone else's benefit. I don't know why you guys are so upset. We're doing it for you. Yeah, that would not play well, I don't think. Well, that's it for this week, guys. I think we put in our work, had a really fun interview with Noam Chomsky, and the ensuing discussion, I think, really dovetailed in well. It's amazing how some of these shows come together. If you'd like to get back to us, hey, if you're upset about the Noam Chomsky interview, if you don't like the or you don't like the scorched earth approach of reforming journalism, send us a message. We want to hear from you. The We Are Libertarians Facebook page or the Twitter account is fully available to the public. Please leave us a message on there. Use the show report hashtag so we are sure to see that pop out at us. Visit WeAreLibertarians.com for more stories and commentary from the show report team. Listen in on iTunes or wall-radio.com to hear past episodes. The show report also plays on our favorite station, IndianaTalks.com. And remember, folks, when the mainstream media breaks the news, the show report is here to fix it. Good night, everyone.